Hi everybody, hope you're well. My name is Jim Carroll, welcoming you to another Banter podcast from the Banter team. We'd also like to say hello to many new listeners who've joined us over the last few weeks. We hope you enjoy what you hear. This is one of two very special Banter podcasts to bring a great busy year to a close. Recorded at MVP in Dublin earlier this month, we were joined by Cathy Sheridan from the Irish Times, Gráinne Healy from the Yes Equality Campaign, and radio producer Zoe Cummins to review a year of new stories, from the weather and climate change to Syriza and Greece, from Syria to the Marriage Equality Campaign, from Jeremy Corbyn to Donald Trump, from the Land League to Dennis O'Brien, the winners and losers, heroes and villains, great and the good of 2015 brought to order.
Thank you all very much for coming out tonight on a horrible, horrible night. We are joined, this is the annual Banter Review of the Year. It's always the banter which causes, one, the most laughs in the audience, and two, the most inquiries to lawyers afterwards before we put the podcast up. It's really funny. This time last year, there was a guy called Mick Wallace on the panel. I'm just thinking earlier on, it's a good job he wasn't on the panel this year because we'd be getting in touch with the old squad car, you know? Instead, we're joined by three formidable people tonight. On my immediate right, we have Cathy Sheridan. You know her as an Irish Times columnist and staff writer. She's also the presenter of the Irish Times Women's Podcast. And lest we forget, she's the co-author of The Builders, how a small group of property developers fueled the building boom and transformed Ireland. Next to her, we have Gráinne Healy. Gráinne was this year a co-director of the Yes Equality Campaign and also the co-author of the excellent Ireland Says Yes, a book that would fit in everyone's Christmas stocking. She's also a freelance projects manager and long-time activist and who is or has been the chair of the European Women's Lobby. Lobby's Observatory on Violence Against Women for over a decade, former Vice President of the European Women's Lobby, a former Chairwoman of the National Women's Council of Ireland, and a previous ministerial appointee to the Board of the Equality Authority and the Women's Health Council. And last but not least, we have Zoe Cummins. Zoe is an independent radio producer and founder of New Normal Culture. She produces The Book Show on RT Radio 1 and has produced numerous award-winning documentaries and dramas for radio, including Seen from a Distance, Flights of Fancy, and Another Blooming Day. Please give them a warm round of applause. The housekeeping bit of things. We'll talk for about 50 minutes or so and see how many of these topics we'll get through in that time. And then we'll open up to questions and observations from the floor. So if you've anything to say about what we talk about or anything to say more importantly about what we don't talk about, please let us know at that stage. So we're going to start with something that's kind of very obvious given the day that's in it and given the weekend we've just had. That's the bloody weather. It just seems to be a topic as well. I was noting this, Cathy, on the notes that we had a really, really bad summer weather. But it struck me over the last couple of days, you were in Dingle last weekend as well, and we were just exchanging war stories there about planes being forced to land because of Storm Desmond, that we seem to take great pleasure in talking about the weather and going, wow, wasn't it terrible, and the floods that are down the country at the moment, but we never stop to think about actually why this has all been caused.
We don't, but on the other hand, I really would like to say, I see Una Mullally here in the audience and Ben Fraser, who organised a spoken word side of Other Voices last week, which I thought was a tremendous success. I was involved, but nonetheless. The weather was appalling, and there were planes bouncing off the landing strip in Farran Fore, and these very hipstery musicians were being sort of diverted to Cork and coming back practically on trolleys back to Dingle, and it was all very exciting to watch. But actually, somebody, it might have been Una, who said it to me, that actually it made the place even more special. You actually felt even more isolated and more liberated in a very strange way. So on that occasion, it was actually quite nice to be in the middle of this storm. And you felt very cut off because, you know, I wrote today about the crossing the Connor Pass. I crossed by mistake on the way in, actually, in the dark, and didn't realise how dangerous it was. And on the way out, crossed it on Sunday and just couldn't believe how beautiful it was. But it's a very cut-off place, and you really get a sense of it from that point, even the weather did add to that. But also yesterday, I was sent to Athlone, not really knowing what story I was going for, except that people were living in fear down there. And there really is a sense of terror down there, because what happens in Athlone is, obviously, the Shannon goes through the town, and it's not like they get a flash flood and something dramatic happens. The water is building further upriver, way upriver. And they are waiting, they're watching the rain fall. They know this is all surging into the Shannon from other rivers, from construction sites that should never have happened, you know, areas that are no longer retaining water. So it's getting into the river much more quickly, and it, as we speak, is making its way to Athlone. And that to me is a terrifying thought. They are just waiting. They can do nothing about it. There's nothing to stop it. They can put up all the sandbags they want. They can try and they're down there with their pumps and getting their sandwiches donated and all the rest. But in the end, this is nature at its most powerful. And it is the atmosphere of fear down there is genuine. This isn't the media playing this up. It's real. And you have to think it's a lot of it down there is to do with building where building should not have happened. One man said to me when he said he saw houses coming up in a part of Athlone, and a friend of his said, I remember when I used to ski on the ice there. So clearly it was a floodplain. And that's the sort of thing that's happening. And then you have climate change as a separate thing. So it is a scary, scary thing, and I hope we're all paying attention to
it. Yeah. Do Gráinne and Zoe, do you think people actually realise, just as kind of Katie has kind of like outlined, that some of the problems are caused by us ourselves, by the building practices we've taken on board, and some of them are like, you know, climate change. Climate change just strikes me as this big nebulous thing that's kind of floating around that we don't really understand, and we try to kind of push it away all the time.
I think it's really easy to detach one from the other, and I think we do it all the time. There's no possible way that the cars that I drive and the things that I consume and the plastic that I use has anything to do with... And the meat that I eat has anything to do with the fact that my house is now flooding. And in fact, it's many of the people who are farmers who are feeling the brunt of this. So it's really easy to detach your real life from what's going on out there. And we in the West and more developed countries are absolutely, you know, to blame. It's not the developing countries who are not using all of the resources in the same way that we are that are to blame. But on just on a personal level, I used to live in a house that flooded because it was built 8 inches below the table. And then sort of every winter it would come up and you'd spend 3 months of the year pumping water out. And that feeling of, what am I going to do? There's no way out of this. What am I going to do? I'm either going to have to spend money to rebuild this whole foundation. So I can imagine what those people across the country are feeling. You can see the aerial shots going out across the Midlands. And it's just devastation. Their houses are in a puddle and that's it. And there's no, it's not going to recede for months on end.
I think, though, the issue of, do people really grasp it? I mean, if you look at the manifestos of most of the political parties, many of them don't mention the issue. The one party that were supposed to be there for us all really representing this issue, the Greens, were wiped out in the last election. So I think there is a political gap that we're all going to pay for. We're already actually paying for it. It used to be, you know, when I did geography in school X number of years ago, this was something that in the future was going to be hitting people, and the fact is that we're living it now and our children and our grandchildren are going to be reaping it. But I think there's something about, you know, it is not yet, despite global meetings and despite Mary Robinson's best efforts, the fact is that none of the political parties in Ireland that people go out and vote for in their large numbers are really taking this as a serious issue. And we saw it with the Taoiseach recently going out and asking for, you know, poor old Ireland, let us off, we're only poor old farmers, and, you know, that out in the middle of the Atlantic, and sure, we don't really understand this complicated stuff. You know, it's a cop-out, and we're all going to pay for it.
Yeah. There's also a feeling like, Cathy, when Enda does that kind of shtick of the kind of like the poor old odds, you know, there's almost like he's got one message for consumption abroad and one message for home.
It's true, and to be honest, I'm a bit conflicted about this. I come from a rural background myself, and I know that the beef we eat, for which we're rightly famous, is hugely responsible. I think, I forget the figure I read the other day, but certainly one cow yields far more than, I think, 10 double-decker buses or something appalling like that. I'm very conscious of that, but I'm also conscious that actually it's not simple to ask a beef farmer to chuck everything in for the sake of the national, for the sake of the move to fix the environment, I think, is a big ask. And I mean, if you look at, I noticed news from Beijing in the last few days, if you've seen pictures of the smog there, it's, you know, it's not just us. There is a huge, huge effort to be made, and it needs to be global. We really are a small little pinprick in what's happening around the globe, and we need to get everyone involved, and that's why Paris is so important. Mm.
But even if you don't eat meat, I mean, I was munching away there on almonds the other day, only to look up and find out that it takes 5 litres of water to create one almond, and there's me with my gob full of them, you know.
Like a squirrel.
Absolutely. Might as well be pouring water down the sink, you know.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And in California.
Yeah.
Where they have no water anyway.
Yeah.
But in some ways, you know, when you look at, and again, we've, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger giving us lessons on that we all should be vegetarians, and that is part of the solution, there's no doubt. But I think there's something about, you know, trying to look for political solutions and practical solutions, and I think it's one of the reasons why the Volkswagen scandal was actually so disgusting this year, because what that does is even the things, like the number of people who bought those expensive cars, thinking they were doing it for the good of the planet and the next generation, and then they realised even that was a swizz.
Yeah.
So I think people are very rightly so pissed off with that idea that, you know, even those who are supposedly doing things to help the environment, you can't trust them. So there's a lot of cynicism about it, and there's no clear plan, and that maybe is why it's so worrying.
Yeah, and I think what you, Jim, said, this is all a bit nebulous. I don't think we quite know yet what we're up against. I mean, what scares the wits out of me is when I see what's happening in the Antarctic, you know, and up around the North Pole, and that really does scare me. When I see that we're protected by the, what is that?
Polar ice cap?
No.
Atlantic drift.
Gulf Stream. Yes. Sorry, it's so obvious when you say it. If we lose that, where, you know, there is this joke around the place that, sure, it's not yet, you know, global warming, sure, won't it be great, we can grow grapes and live in wonderful sort of French type existence here. But in fact, if the Gulf Stream and things like that, a couple of degrees lower, and where are we all going to end up?
Yeah.
You know, it's actually serious. But we have to be convinced that it's serious, and that hasn't happened yet. I don't know if there are marketing people here in the audience, but I think a few decent marketing people push a few heads together. Now, are there any marketing people here?
I think it's one or two.
I think
Marketing Anonymous, actually.
I'd love to hear at the end from somebody who thinks what we're doing with ourselves and why we haven't managed to sell this message properly.
I think once Theresa Mannion becomes president, we'll all be fine. She will sort
it. I knew you'd get your Theresa Mannion reference in.
She missed the chance actually to have all that message.
Yeah. It had to be in a wrap as well.
Let's move from the story which we cover every year, like climate change, to the story which we could only cover this year, Grania, and that was like the referendum in May. You know, and you played a pivotal part in that. Like, you've written the book, you've obviously been kind of like appearing on a lot of review shows as well, and thinking back about it, did it all kind of like play out a lot easier in the end than you expected?
God, I don't know about easy.
That's a loved question now.
There was nothing easy about it. No, it didn't, but I guess what it did do was, you know, when the 1.2 million plus votes were counted, there was a sense that I think that surprised all of us, that idea of the overwhelming nature of it. The overwhelming nature of the yes, the numbers of people who went out and did like 70 groups up and down the country, all the partner groups we were involved in, the numbers of people who were knocking on doors from the end of January who were just saying to people, hello, I'm voting yes, can I tell you why? And people took that up and went with it. And in some ways, you know, all of the work that went into it and all of the planning and, you know, the reason we wrote the book was to show that actually there was a kind of a systematic approach to this campaign. So it wasn't those of us who were sitting in head office thinking, let's try this, and we'd run out and try it and it would work. Actually, it was very much based on good research, scientific stuff, asking people, what are the kinds of things that will move you? What are the messages and what are the messengers? And matching that up. It was systematic, it was planned, and we managed to get the kind of support. But most importantly, we managed to get people around the country, and the vote was up and down the country, to be willing to talk to their mas and their das and their grandas and the people they work with and actually have a conversation about this issue. That's what won it. Yeah. There's no doubt about that.
And like, I mean, in hindsight, I mean, it's interesting. Like Cathy, you mentioned Una being the audience. We talked to Una at Banter at Other Voices at the weekend, and the point came up about the fact that like having those conversations for gay and lesbian people was really, really hard. And I think it's something that only in hindsight us straights realised was really, really hard. And like, I mean, I know for a fact that like it's only after the event that I kind of realised myself. It's a very hard thing to do, to talk about something you may never have talked about before.
Going out night after night, talking to family, which is often hard, talking to strangers on the doorstep, so people saying, I'm a lesbian, I'm asking you to vote for this reason. Mm. So coming out to utter strangers. But it was interesting on the canvas, I mean, we didn't get all positive responses on the doors. But actually, and we set up some counselling and we set up some psychotherapists who would deal with people who'd had particularly negative responses. But, you know, the people who were most shocked by the responses and the negative responses were the straight people on the canvas. They couldn't believe that people were still opening doors and saying hurtful, homophobic things. And in some ways, it was the lesbian and gay people who were saying, ah, yes, I've heard worse than that.
That's what I've seen before. Yeah.
And that was something that I think maybe shocked a lot of people.
Well, I remember Una again, seeing her on the Claire Byrne Live. Sorry, Una. That was my first experience of sitting there. You were on with John Lyons, and opposite you was Keith
Mills.
Breathe O'Brien, maybe? Yeah. And I actually flew into a rage that night, just at the sight of you two having to explain to people what you were about. I thought it was shocking. I really did. And I'm still, the idea that people had to sacrifice their privacy in every conceivable way for that was appalling. And on the other hand, there were so many joyful moments, and Gráinne and I were just talking so earlier about one of the great things, again at Dingle, the very sight of joy of Boat to Vote. He was down on a panel down there, and I must say, I laughed out loud when I saw him, because it reminded me of what a joyful moment that was that morning when that hashtag took off, Home to Vote and Boat to Vote. And that, for me, I will always remember that. When I'm very, very old, I will remember that morning and watching that hashtag take off. And Gráinne did tell me earlier, I had a tear in my eye that morning when I saw that. Gráinne told me earlier what?
Yeah, that was the only time in the whole of the campaign that I actually shed a tear. I mean, other people were crying at other points, but when I woke up that, like, whatever it was, 5 o'clock in the morning, and that photograph of people up in Dublin Airport holding up their passports, even now, thinking about it, I can tear up. I thought, this is absolutely incredible. But, you know, it was down to people having conversations, but it was also, I mean, I'm glad that Una is here tonight, because actually, you know, Una came out and spoke so publicly about herself, her experience, why this was a real issue, that wonderful article that she wrote about why for her and her partner, going into a hospital situation, having to explain who your partner is, and the idea of the kind of clarity of being able to be married and have a relationship that's recognised, how if you haven't had that experience, you really can't understand it. And that article in particular, I believe, moved the parents of many other people who have children who are unwell or who've had cancer. And that idea of, as you say, my mother used to say, you know, going out and telling your private business.
Yeah.
That's what women like Una did. That's what many of us did. And you shouldn't have to do it.
No.
But my God, it's powerful when
and
you do it.
Can I just add that I just realised today when I was kind of looking back on it with great joy, I realised what a huge role women did play in it, if I may say so. I mean, Ursula Halligan was a game changer.
Yeah.
Very sad, very poignant, but nonetheless a game changer. Mary McAleese was a game changer. Una was a game changer. You, Gráinne, were a game changer.
Leo Varadkar as well, I think.
Leo Varadkar in
exactly.
But I'm just talking about women for the moment. Yes. A mere man.
Before we go on from this, I just want to just something else, Gráinne. Did you say earlier on that Noel Whelan cried as well when...
In the book, one of the plates, I think it was Dervin MacDonald actually from The Independent caught him crying outside on Parliament Street after we had walked out from Dublin Castle after the vote had been announced. And the number of people who had come up to Noel, literally putting their arms around him, crying and saying, thank you, thank you, thank you. And he turned around and he said, I cannot believe this. And the next thing, he's crying. And I'm like, come on, pull yourself together. We've more stuff to do. We've to go and we've to do this. So he did. And then the image of that was posted recently of Brian Sheehan, my co-director, who the day we arrived into the count that morning, and we arrived in, and it was just overwhelming. And again, he's caught kind of crying. So I've come out as, you know, the hard one, who actually, the only time she cried was at 5 o'clock in the morning when she saw the Home to Vote.
Okay. Yeah. Like you mentioned Leo Varadkar there. So do you think, like, I mean, the fact that, like, people, like, politicians like Leo Varadkar and Pat Carey coming out this year as well as the kind of yes, the victory for the Yes campaign in the referendum, does that, like, indicate a new Ireland to you, or is it an Ireland that was always there and is just finally waking up?
Well, I think it's that, but I also think that now that this year is coming to a close, I think that it's quite good that we can now look at them as just politicians, just doing their job, and not have to look at their sexuality. And I think that's something that's happened over the last year. Certainly, you know, in my car, bringing kids around the place, as a, you know, having a family, that it's a completely normal vocabulary that we have now. It's not something that, you know, we have to sit down and talk about. It's just something that you chat about in the back of the car, and it's a very normal thing. It's not a thing, in fact, anymore. In fact, to the point where my children now think that the two sisters who live together next door have to be married because, you know, that's the way it's going. The only people I feel sorry for, though, are the people in Roscommon South Beatrim who took a bit of a battering, you know, when they voted
no. They elected Ming the Merciless. They deserve everything they get.
There was a comment on, and now I forget who said it, but said, if you want to know what Roscommon was like 50 years ago, go there now. And then, you know, to get a sense. But it's possibly a little unfair.
Unless Corny wants to add something, let's leave the poor Peter and Roscommon alone.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at the numbers, Roscommon missed it by like 1,100 votes, like really small amount. And the fact is that one of the difficulties Roscommon has is that everyone from Roscommon is living in Dublin. If most of the people in Dublin who are from Roscommon knew the vote was going to be that close, they'd have gone down there and registered their vote, and it would have gone white along with all of the others. So, and actually, in the back of the book, we included Roscommon's post-referendum statement. It's a beautiful piece of writing, and it's well worth a read at the back of the book.
Do you think, Ronia, like, I mean, having seen how and conducted, directed the whole campaign, are there lessons there to be learned for other campaigners? Because, I mean, I can't remember, my mind's a blank, who reviewed the book in the Irish Times. I know it wasn't Peter... When he reviewed the book, he was kind of saying, "This is a handbook for any kind of the no side to look at and learn from the mistakes." It's like, are there lessons for political campaigners and other campaigners to learn from how you worked?
Yeah, I mean, it was one of the inverted commas criticisms that some people made. Oh, you know, you're giving away all the secrets of how you won the campaign. But I guess in writing the book, we were clear, like, the no side have all of the resources and have always had the resources, because they're many of the same people who've been no against most things that we know. So they have the resources and they have the money to do the kind of research. I think we were writing the book to say, this is possibly one of the first referenda campaigns where we decided that it would have to be done taking the advice of people who had loads of advice of winning and losing referendums, which is about, it's got to be about research. What are the messages? So going forward, looking at, for example, the repeal of the Eighth Amendment, I think there are some lessons that you could lift from this. There are others that don't pertain at all.
What lessons in particular do you think?
Well, I think the idea of doing a research-based approach, so go out there now and it'll have to be done, money will have to be spent, where we need to talk to people about what are the areas where, you know, people are willing to move from a very polarised conversation into the middle. Because either we're trying to win a referendum or we're trying to win an argument, and they're two entirely different strategies. So if you want to win a referendum, you've got to get the million in the middle. And the research will tell you what are the messages and who are the messengers. And for me, that was one of the key successes of the campaign. Yes, we had to get people out, we had to get them to vote, all of that, win a positive campaign. The repeal of the Eighth will be different, but I believe the secret will be in getting the research right and looking at, you know, who are the messengers? Who are the people? There's no doubt that there are mothers in Ireland who've had to travel with their daughters to have abortions because they've been carrying dead babies over to the UK. Hearing those stories is hugely powerful. So who are we trying to get in terms of the million in the middle? Who are those voters? What's their age? What's their gender? What's their current position? And who will they listen to? Because one of the mistakes we made back in the 80s when we reran these earlier referenda on abortion was we let the medics and the legal people run away with it, and the church. Now, a lot of those people no longer have the kind of authority that they did, and I think one of the ways of capitalising on those changes in authority is actually to do a bit of research and to say, okay, if we're all agreed that we're not just trying to win an argument, let's see how we can win a referendum on this issue finally. There are some lessons in the book.
I think, Jim, can I just add, that as the daughter of a politician from about 300 years ago, when all we ever did was canvass, there was no social media. It knocked on the flaming doors, night, noon and morning. And I remember dancing with drunks in Longford Town Hall or wherever it was in order to raise funds. I would have been one of the original fundraisers, but for a whole different cause. But the election of Joe Sheridan straight and independent. But the canvas was a thing. It was a knocking on doors, and I think that's one of the things. It's a lesson, and I really did worry whether the young would come out for that referendum. And boy, did they ever come out. But will they come out again? And that's my next worry. And the thing to tell everybody is the canvas works. And Una knows that as well as anybody here, because she did it herself, even while she had been diagnosed with a very serious illness. Mm. You have to knock on the blooming doors. There's no social media is going to save that day for you unless you go and meet the people.
Mm. Without having access to the research and just going on a gut feeling, like, Zoe, do you think, you know, that if the referendum on the 8th is held again, that this time will be carried?
I actually don't know the answer to that question. In my heart, I'd like to say yes, but I don't know that it will, because it's I think, a more contentious issue than the marriage referendum, and it's been knocked back before. I wouldn't say yes, but it would, but I do think that what you're saying about having the right messengers to carry that might help it, and it's maybe identifying who those are and how to get that information out there and how to access people. But I don't think if it was held today, no, it would be passed.
Okay. Most years, there's always kind of like, I mean, one or two foreign stories that kind of pop up. And this year, like Daesh, ISIS, those horrific attacks in Paris at the start of the year in Charlie Hebdo, the attacks in Tunisia on the beach over the summer, and more lately, like Paris again, you know, kind of kept them in the news. It's one of those kind of stories that, like, you find yourself reading these pieces on these terrorists, you know, and you kind of find all the different shades of opinion on them as well. Like, Cathy, as the year went by, do you find yourself kind of like, I mean, paying more attention to them in ways that you didn't expect to?
I'll be honest now, and I'm probably, this isn't at all a cool thing to say, but when the debate was going on last week about bombing Syria in the House of Commons, I honestly changed my mind every 3 minutes. And I still haven't made up my mind about it. I want to get those guys and cut their throats, quite honestly. When I heard of the mass graves of the Yazidi, the older Yazidi women, who were, in case none of you know, there were mass graves found in a place called Sinjar when the Kurds reoccupied it. They found mass graves of older women, of older Yazidi women, who had been killed because they were too old to be sex slaves. That's ISIS. Now, it's an attitude that you might think is prevalent in some parts of the world, and this was just the extreme end of it. But when I hear those kind of stories, when I hear of little 12-year-olds being made sex slaves, when I hear how they abuse Islam, I'm not defending any religion here, but nonetheless, there is a side to Islam that is loved by many people and to whom it is a great comfort. So I would defend it at that level. All of these things, I actually really feel murderous towards them. And then I feel bad about it. And then I think, no, there must be other ways. These guys will not talk to anyone. They will not negotiate. Assad will not negotiate. He just is smirking at everyone. I don't know the answer, but I am paying very close attention. On the way up here, I heard a guy, this Kerry councillor in the car, talking about 12 Syrian families who are moving in to Killarney. And he was saying, oh, they're going to displace 12 families. And they probably are going to displace 12 people, 12 families in Killarney. But his other attitude was, we don't know who these people are. We don't know who they are. What are they? In other words, he's implying there will be terrorists among them. I mean, on the one hand, I think that is utterly disgraceful. On the other hand, I think there is a terrible information vacuum.
Yeah.
The people should have been told how these people had been vetted. They should be told where the houses are coming from. All of those things. None of this is simple. It's a very complex. It's a very complex area. Yeah. But as to how you deal with terrorists who are prepared to be killed themselves, I do not know, Jim. I don't know where you go with that.
I don't think there is an answer to it. I think in Paris, I think it's interesting that they seem to. The French, to a certain extent, seem to have wiped their memory in terms of the Algerian conflict, you know, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, and that a lot of what's happening in France, they're a specific target because of a civil war that happened in the 50s and 60s in Algeria. And, you know, there's 5,500, 6,000 Muslims living in France, and 5.5 million of them are from Algeria. And there's a context there that we don't discuss, we don't talk about. It's not... And people are becoming radicalized very, very quickly It's not sort of, you know, the younger generation are becoming radicalised very, very quickly, but it's coming out of this context.
So what is radicalised in this context? It means joining a street gang and getting a gun. You know, radicalised is one thing. I'd be radical in several ways, but I think what they're doing is beyond... Yeah. I think it's abusing the word radical.
I'm also amazed I know that you've got kids in Southampton and Brighton who are being flying into Turkey, taking a bus down to the border, crossing over, and joining up with Daesh. And you're kind of going like, what's so radical? Like, what exactly was happening to you in Southampton and Brighton that made you do this? Yeah. And that, to my mind, I can't understand that bit. Maybe it's because I'm not a 19-year-old Muslim living in those particular areas. But like, when you say radicalized, I'm kind of going what exactly was happening to force you to do that?
Well, I think that we're more connected now, so there's a lot of communication going back and forth that nobody understands or has access to at the moment.
I think, though, there's also, and again, listening to, you know, how unpopular some of the things that Jeremy Corbyn has been saying, and I was over at the British Labour Party conference where he made his first speech, and, you know, in many ways, people can be critical of him and think, you know, what he's saying is old left rubbish. But the fact is, and we know this from the island that we live on, we're going to have to get a political solution to this. So, you know, there are brains in the world, there are people, there are some people here who have experience of... I know absolutely there are some of them who don't want to listen, and there may be some of them that need to be taken out in order to ensure that we can get to a political solution. But the truth is that a political solution will have to be found. Yeah. And there seems to be, when you're bombing, you're not looking for political solutions. And that, for me, is the... I absolutely understand, Cathy's, that feeling of, you know, you want to bomb the bastards and you see what they're doing. And as a feminist, I think they have done despicable things. I mean, the description of how they are keeping women in prison in their own towns in these areas on the basis that they know if they keep the women, the men will stay. Like, there are horrendous things going on.
Or how they're dividing up women as well, given to fighters as prizes.
Exactly. But having said all of that, there has to be a political solution, and it needs, you know, people need to be thinking about that now. And the bombing just keeps us away from doing that. Yeah.
I mean, maybe the political solution will be supplied by a man up in Drumcondra called Bertie Ahern, who, according to the Irish Times at the weekend, of all places, is on the road to rehabilitation, doing, peace brokering left, right and centre. I was amazed by that.
Do you want me to deal with this?
What?
Do you want me to deal with this?
Yeah, do that. But getting back to the kind of like Syrian issues, Zoe. I mean, it's one of those kind of foreign issues we don't really understand. It's spread so much, and it's like it's only when it kind of like appears to be, it turns up on our doorstep, as in like a Tunisian beach where Irish people are on holidays, or Paris the same weekend the U2 concert's on, that we suddenly realise this shit is real.
Well, I think that we can grab hold of something if it's presented to us in stark enough terms, and I think that the picture of Aylan Kurdi on the beach, the 2-year-old who was washed up in Turkey, that really allowed people to have an access point into this. And the fact that there are 750,000 people coming into Europe in the last year, you know, trying to get in, and there are waiting camps outside Europe, it really is on our doorstep, and that's when we're starting to take notice. But there are no solutions. I've heard no solutions. I don't have the solutions. And this is the problem. I think with the, you know, with refugees coming in and economic migrants, that it's, you know, they're fleeing from places where terror reigns, and they're coming here, and the fear that people feel of who these people are is not going to go away, and the way we deal with migration hasn't changed in the last 10 to 15 years. So, you know, we need to think very quickly as how to deal with this, because what we've been doing for the last 20 odd years isn't working, and now we've got a problem right on our doorstep. And if we keep thinking of it as our doorstep, and not everybody's kind of doorstep. I mean, obviously, Europe can't house the world's problems. It can't do that. So there has to be a solution, but we don't have a solution. So what?
Totally. And like, I mean, as those refugees are turning up in Europe, people's attitudes here are changing enormously. I was in Germany the other weekend. I couldn't get over some of the comments people were making about, like, I mean, the refugees there. On one hand, a couple months earlier, they were kind of praising Merkel to the sky for her open door policies and showing a humanitarian streak they hadn't realised she had. And now it's like, I mean, well, they're coming over here. They're taking our villages. They're taking over our social welfare. And it's a natural human response, but it's also extremely vulgar and extremely, like, I mean, just quite horrific to see people that you actually like and admire voicing these attitudes.
But there's been 330,000 people arrive in Germany. It's quite a frightening situation, I suppose, for people who don't know their own economy and don't know how they're going to get by, and seeing all these people coming in, it is a frightening situation to know what's going to happen. I suppose.
Yeah, but particularly in Germany, you know, when they had numbers that were coming in that were working in the jobs that many of the Germans didn't want to do, and they were moving into sectors that other people didn't want to do, this was all acceptable. So I think there is the double think around, you know, there's the strange threat and here they are coming in, but there is also, I think, the reality of Europe needing to think. I mean, there's no doubt that, you know, since the Second World War and how Europe has grown, the first priority of the original European Union was peace. And this current situation and what is driving the terror is the biggest threat to world peace and in particular to European peace. Mm. So again, it's back to the political people need to be looking for a solution to this and showing leadership to people.
Well, can I just say, the Time magazine has just announced its person of the year as?
Angela Merkel.
Angela Merkel, yes. Whom they describe as the Chancellor of Free Europe.
Yeah.
The two people behind her were? Al-Baghdadi, the head of ISIS, and Donald Trump.
Right.
Are we a confused world or what?
Well, the Donald Trump narrative I find fascinating. I can't believe that buffoon is still in the race for a start. You know, and when he came out with you the other night about, like, okay, we're going to stop the Muslims, in our tracks. There was a poll conducted recently. He's at 32%. Everyone else in the kind of Republican race is on single figures. Is America completely and utterly lost its marbles? Or is there something about Trump power that I'm missing here?
He is. I think he's social media brought to life. Quite honestly, I don't think he's all social media, but he's the comments. He's the below the line commentators. He is the social media side that we all try to pretend doesn't exist because we have our followers and they follow us back, and they're the civilized side. But in fact, it's one of those things. It's like Zoe said about the ignoring the context of the banlieues in France. I think Donald Trump is that person. He is the bad side of social media come to life. And I think the frightening thing is that he has this enormous support. Did anybody see when he made that statement about banning all Muslims? There was an enormous cheer.
Yeah.
No, there was no dead silence. It was, people were delighted with him. Anybody who wants to watch him giving a speech, now, obviously they are by definition fans of his, but this shooting gesture they all make, they know what he's going to say, the enthusiasm alone is scary. Mm. It's I don't know. And I don't think it's just American, Jim. I think we like to flatter ourselves we don't have that in our midst, but we do.
And this is from a man who's never used an ATM machine in his life. And Time magazine said that he also used to sit and read the foreclosure notices just for a bit of fun, you know?
Yeah.
Sit there, a bit of light reading at the weekend. I mean, lost their home.
There's some amazing, there's an old profile from 1982 or 83 in the New Yorker magazine of him. And you read that and it's not even 1982 or 83, it's right now. He just doesn't seem to have changed at all. Do you think, Grania, I know this is kind of a question that if we'd asked a year ago, people would just have laughed. But like, there's every indication that he is going to be the Republican nominee, and he is going to, this time next year, we will know if he has beaten Hillary Clinton or whoever will stand for the Democrats. I mean, it's like a thought from a comic, I have to say.
It's true, and, you know, it's when you watch the speeches and you hear what he's saying, and then you read it in print, and, you know, many people, anyone who would say those kinds of things here would be ridiculed or laughed, especially saying publicly. But the fact is, he has huge support. The fact is, he has all the money that is required to bring him to the seat of power. I mean, these are facts. This is a man who we used to laugh at him. He's not to be laughed at now. He is actually to be feared. And there is a requirement of the sensible people in America to try to... I mean, there is loads of dirt on that guy. It needs to be put out there. People need to know what he's done, where he's come from, you know, and I think that that's really what the Democrats should be doing.
I don't think that would make a blind bit of difference.
Well,
the kind of followers he has, they don't care what he's done.
Yeah, maybe not.
I mean, how does he represent small-town America? They think he does. Mm. But that's what's really weird about it.
Yeah, totally.
But in terms of the whole gun lobby and his, you know, his view around that, I mean, you know, Obama's statement the other evening about what he was going to do about that, it was so limp compared to the sort of stuff he goes on and says, you know, everyone should have a gun, and the reason the people in Paris were all shot down was that they didn't all have a gun to protect themselves.
Actually, can I just recommend all of you, there was a, on Twitter today, there was somebody sort of said Angela Merkel, Time Woman of the Year, and the comments below it were horrifying. And they were mainly about commie Jews. It got into a big battle about gun rights. And the attitude, it became an America versus Europe debate. Debate is a kind word for it. But it was absolutely a sign of how mad some people are, both in Europe and in America.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't know. I'm as scared of them as I am of the terrorists, quite honestly, because they are living amongst us in a very real way, but we don't know them. Like you said, Jim, you were in Germany last week, and at least people were honest with you and talked out loud about what their thoughts, and you were quite shocked by it. Mm. You see, I sometimes think we really are just talking to ourselves, and that worries me as well. I would think I probably like all of you personally, because you just happen to be here. But I mean, if we were to go outside and try and talk to a bunch of people, you know, further down the street, what would they be saying tonight about the Syrians coming to Ireland?
Sorry?
Well, I was just going to go back to the gun. I was just looking at a Christmas card there by Michelle Fiores in Nevada. She's not a senator, I'm not sure, in the assembly, yeah. And she has a Christmas card of three generations on her, all in Christmas jumpers, toting firearms. And, you know, she sent it out to all her constituents, and people applaud her for it. It's, you know, we love to see you with a gun there. Well done to you, you know, with...
Yeah. Before we leave Donald Trump, Gordon, one question for you. You said there, like, one thing is to kind of compile a dossier of kind of like mean shit on him. Did she compile dossiers in the Yes Equality campaign on any of the opposition figures? Straight yes or no?
No.
Okay, perfect. Let's move back to home then. Another kind of questions back at home. Like, there's a couple of things which kind of stand out, like the jilling of Anglo-Irish bank officials, the banking inquiry. And one question for all of you: has Dennis O'Brien sued anyone here on the panel?
Letter from
me months.
I'm amazed that several of you in the room haven't got a letter from him. I made some very harmless reference to him after a global economic forum in Dublin Castle. And the next day, I got a letter reminding me very severely of my duty to the truth, and a very thick file of cuttings from the tribunal explaining where he had been traduced. And it was, I mean, there is a thing called the chilling effect, Jim.
Yeah, we talked about this, yeah.
Yes. And that, you do, of course, think... And he's become more and more powerful. I deeply resent the fact that that he has a monopoly, and that we seem unable to deal with it. He really does have a monopoly.
Mm.
It's actually very scary. He can influence the best-selling papers in this country. They may deny it, and I'm sure they're trying not to be influenced. But there is such a thing as just second-guessing your boss, and we all do it in one way or another. And that's what's very scary about it. Zoe, I know you worked for...
I mean, you don't actually, when you're on the floor of any of the radio stations in Communicore, you don't actually have much day-to-day dealings. I did have one interaction with him, but only one, when a piece of work I did won an award, and he talked to me for a few minutes about it and then said, well, congratulations, Zoe Cummins, you worked for 20... It took 20 hours to do this piece of work, when actually it took maybe 20 weeks, you know. So there's a sort of a misunderstanding. But actually, you don't have any communication with him when you're on the floor of when you're working for him.
Do you find, you had mentioned the chilling effect. Do you kind of find that the people understand this? That actually people understand the kind of power the rich people have by virtue of the fact that they can actually afford lawyers, and they can afford to go to court, and they can afford to kind of like bring things in and actually try and put manners on you in that way?
I think there's no doubt that... you know, the legal system here, and indeed in most countries, but particularly in Ireland, you know, if you've got deep pockets, you can use that to protect your own interests, even if they happen to be against the public interest. And I think that's something that there have been some, you know, over the years, some people who have looked at this, who've named it, you know, they've been gone after. And unfortunately, when you're a private individual with a family and a mortgage and a career, there are people who have paid the price.
Or even, actually, I'd like to say, when you're not a private individual, I don't know if many of you remember when there was a big row about, he tried to stop Catherine Murphy's Dahl statements being published. And a few people were very brave and went for it. The Irish Times has been stung very severely for millions for actions they have taken over recent years. But what I remember most about that is people who don't buy the bloody paper, who probably read it online for nothing, saying we were a bunch of cowards, that we would not publish Catherine Murphy's statement. And I'm quite sure we would have given a lot of time and thought on whether we should or shouldn't. Obviously, the decision was taken at a far higher pay grade than mine not to do it. And I regret that. At the same time, as Grainne says, in one way or another, we all have to live and survive. And in this weird age we're in, where people get a lot of their information for nothing, see no reason why they should pay for it. I think they're not in a great position to go demanding that other people put their livelihoods on the line. And that's something I'd like everybody to remember who think that information should be free, that people like Una, again, that our column should come free all the time, that everybody that invest very seriously expensive investigations should come free. Like RTE's investigates the other night, but those councillors, that obviously took months and months of time to research and investigate. They do get a licence fee from all of us if you bother to pay it. They also get the advertising fees. They operate in a different business model, and good luck to them. At the same time, I'd say for a private outfit like ours, where we try to live from day to day in a very dangerous market where we're all flailing around for ways to make it pay, just bear that in mind. It's not an easy decision to make if you're up against the likes of Dennis O'Brien and he's saying publish. Go ahead and publish. See what I'll do.
I mean, another way around the kind of like, I suppose there's another take on the legal side, which you saw earlier on this year when we had the Land League getting into bed with the O'Donnell family and Gorse Hill. I mean, am I right in thinking that does anyone here in the panel subscribe to what is it called? Is it freemanship? Does anyone believe that's the way we should be going? Or did most people look at the whole Land League scenario when that was going on with just sheer halberd laughter?
I mean, it was just, I think with the economic circumstances of the country and what people are going through, that there is going to be no sympathy for somebody who has a house on a very expensive road in Dublin. Everyone is entitled to a home, of course, but not that sort of home. And I don't think that there was going to be anyone apart from those Land Leaguers standing behind him.
Well, like this Land League thing, Cathy, I mean, yeah, have you followed in any way? I mean,
I covered that case. Yeah.
What do you make of
it? It was endlessly enthralling. There were 8 Land Leaguers there. And these are the guys who actually stopped an Allsops auction. This is how they were marching down to protest at people farms being pulled out from under the farmers and that sort of thing. And they spotted this auction going on, and they began to sing the national anthem, and quote from a sort of a speech of Charles Stewart Parnell. And I am all for people getting at the banks. Let me make that very clear. At the same time, these guys, they had a little history of their own that wasn't all that encouraging if you were a little person trying to, you know, fighting a little game against the bank. Not a little game, really a serious game against the bank. They became the actual de facto spokespeople for the O'Donnell family, whose art at one point was valued at 7.5 million, and the next thing was valued at 5 million. And the next thing, I don't know where the art went, but it seemed to have been presented to each of the children. I could be wrong about that. I hope there's no O'Donnell in the room. Or if there is, let's hear where the art went. And there was, I mean, there was that house that Jerry Beads from the new Land League called Bog Standard. All of that was absolutely amazing. Those people, I think they were something like, each of the children, as you know, they were occupying that house at some point. There was a terrific legal thing going on where the law really did begin to look like an ass. And you're sitting there and you're thinking, they were up and down from the courts, the appeal court, the Supreme Court, back to the appeal court, and you're thinking, the appeal court, to any ordinary person, is the court of last resort. In fact, it's not. You can go back to the Supreme Court again. And meanwhile, there were 2 of them. They had no lawyers. There were 7 for the Bank of Ireland, I seem to remember, because they were the ones in the hot seat at the time. And for the first time and only time in my life, I actually felt some sympathy for a bank. They were absolutely, because the O'Donnells just got stuck in. There was no shame. It was entirely brazen. And as far as I know, they're out of there now. But the whole thing became a ridiculous. The Land League's involvement to me was an offence. It was offensive.
But what I'm struck by is, like, leaving the O'Donnells aside, what I'm struck by is the fact that there is people who turn to the Land League who actually believe the utter shite they're coming out with. Like, I mean, in terms of like freemen, in terms of that kind of like that archaic stuff from many years. And there's many people who seem to be in such desperate straits that they're prepared to turn to these aegis.
See, Jim,
help.
I think that's the point. I think that's the point. And again, I'll cite my rural background. I know what it's like to feel. That your land is in danger, and it may have been in the family for 3-4 generations. And a lot of city people have no sympathy for that. They just think it's a business, not paying. Get out. Just sell it. Go on. It's not like that. A lot of these guys have no money. They're living fairly desperate existences, but to them, this land represents something precious that is almost living. It's a living thing. And any of you who've seen the field will have some little insight into that. Wasn't exaggerated. I think there is that. So farmers, and also there's a huge pride thing. Mm. You know, you don't want the neighbours to see you sort of in financial trouble. And farmers, in my experience, don't talk to one another. They don't confess. I have interviewed many, many farmers in my time, and I was just saying this to somebody last week. They never tell you the bloody truth about their earnings. You could ask them till time, kingdom come, they will never tell you what their income is. You go down and you see a lovely house that's probably been sort of newly built. There is a man there in quite a nice 4x4, and he gives you a little tour of his little land, and he shows you the cattle and all the rest, and it's all lovely. And he's saying, my income is 12,000 a year. And you're thinking, how do you do this? And then you discover the wife maybe is a teacher. So that's very nice. He's got that regular income. But in the meantime, you are thinking, there obviously is more to this. And I've never quite worked out what it is. Maybe they found a way of living on 12,000 a year.
Maybe they're members of the executive council of the IFA.
Actually, this guy was a big cheese in the IFA.
I rest my case.
You may have hit something there.
Okay. Well, one other foreign story I want to turn to, because I mean, I realise that as I expected that the hour is kind of is rattling away. One other foreign story that seemed to have, like that definitely took wing at the start of the year, and then it kind of petered out when everyone realised that the ideal wasn't as great as reality was Greece and Syriza, and that whole kind of idea that like, I mean, you could have a popular uprising, you could elect a lad who looks great in a suit without a tie, and everything would be hunky dory. When actually it didn't turn out to be anything like that. Did all of you kind of feel that there was a great wave of optimism around what Syriza were doing, and it, as reality came on board and as the kind of like the European mandarins took hold of their finance minister and kicked him around a little bit, the reality kind of set in, and that all the lessons are learned. I certainly felt this the weekend. We talked to Ona Bren from Sinn Féin down at Banderas Oral Voices, and you kind of got the feeling that any hopes they had of emulating what was going on there quickly dissipated.
I think that there was a period of time where those of us who'd be idealists thought, Jesus, maybe these guys are actually going to book it. Maybe they are going to do what we weren't able to do here in Ireland, where we had to bow the knee and go through the austerity and, you know, all that horrible stuff. But by holding it and then going back for re-election, you think, God, the Greek people are really behind it. But, I mean, you know, then I hear from friends who are living in Greece and they're talking about people jumping out of buildings and they're talking about, you know, men walking into the sea and people losing their houses and their land and people who've been civil servants all their lives, they've no pension. The reality of the dawning reality that actually, guys, there is no magic way. We're going to have to go the way Ireland and others have gone, and that for them, the hole is actually much deeper than our hole. And they're still, I mean, I was in Athens 3 weeks ago at a conference. I met the mayor of Athens. I was talking to him. Your heart would break for the people there. They're still at the very early stages. They haven't really even begun to feel the kind of cuts, relatively speaking, that Irish people went through in, you know, the previous 5 years.
So in hindsight then, the fact that we went through all these cuts then, Cathy, was a good thing.
Well, if we can just stay with Greece for a minute, because it really was quite a fascinating period for all of us. Totally agree with Gráinne. I thought, Lord, these guys are finally going to prove we should have stuck with it and burnt the bloody bondholders and all the stuff that went with that. We can stand up to Europe. These are going to show us how to do it. And I remember writing a column saying that this was a bunch of academics, serious academics, the game theory, all the rest, and activists, who were with not a day's experience between them, a day's political experience between them, but nonetheless going for it, fearless, going on theory, going they'd worked with the people, but can you do it? And I wrote that column, and I remember getting a lot of abuse below the line from people saying, oh, so you don't want academics to have a go, you don't want the activists to have a go, you prefer a bunch of teachers, which was actually a sly dig at Enda Kenny and his ilk. But I remember being a bit worried that there may be... People are naive going into politics, in my view, anyway. Anybody who's ever gone into politics the first time will tell you the first few years are outrageously difficult because they're finding their way around and all the rest. In the case of Varoufakis, I think he went in with an unbelievable amount of arrogance. That guy did not take into account that he was using his game theory about a country where people really were on the brink. And his ego, I think, took over. And that's what upsets me about all of that. I think they might just have squeaked it if they'd had a guy who'd gone off and done a little bit of homework about how to succeed politically. And we know what he did. We know he annoyed the knickers off everybody in Europe and then had to be deposed, basically. And that I found really upsetting because it handed the whole game to the EU bureaucrats. On the other hand, I would also say, Grainne, we had a lot of things going for us that Greece didn't. I mean, they have a serious record of corruption and of graft that we actually didn't have. Now, we all might think we're the worst in the world. We're actually not. We're actually not far from the top in terms of Transparency International. Greece are way down there. Mm. They have a long way to go in terms of reform. Mm. And they weren't really acknowledging that. And I felt there were a number of things there that made me very uneasy about it. But actually the total turnaround that Alexis Tsipras had to do in the end was a heartbreak. Mm. I will say that. And what I'm hearing from you, Grainne, it's going to get worse.
Okay, I'm going to turn it off to the audience right now, just because we've been talking for an hour, so there's a whole load of stuff we haven't even got anywhere near, including, I'm just going to call out some of the stuff here, if there's kind of things we haven't talked about yet, that each one of you want to talk about. Zoe?
I just know.
Yeah.
Throw me something there and I'll... I don't have the list of...
There's things like The Return of Adele, Carrying Minds Fire, Waking the Feminists, called Netflix and Chill... Jeremy Corbyn, we mentioned him. The Inflatable Minions. Clampdown on Dublin Cyclists. Oh, and also, does anyone in the audience know who Julie Lawrence is?
She's the one who died in the prison cell, is she?
No. Julie Lawrence is the woman who sent an invoice to the mother of a child that interrupts her birthday party.
But there's a whole sort of black market that goes on outside school gates with, you know, invitations and money changing hands. I mean, the amount of money that changes hands between parents to get birthday presents.
In
Well, all over Dublin and all over the country, I'd say. It's actually disgusting, I have to say, that there are, you know, for each child you give over a tenner and someone gives you back a tenner for your kid and then you do a tenner this way and a tenner that way. And it's just a preposterous system that
everyone... It's kidonomics.
Kidonomics, that's right. It, yeah.
Is there anything you want to talk about?
Well, I suppose Waking the Feminist is very important to talk about. I don't know if anyone else was in the Abbey on the day that Waking the Feminist took to the stage, but it was an extraordinary moment and something that I think has really awakened people in Ireland. I think there was 30 or so actresses, directors, performers who took to the stage to give 90 seconds apiece to say what should have been said years ago. And I've worked in media, worked in theatre, I've written plays, but actually I was in a way blind to what was going on. And for years you say, oh well, yes, maybe there isn't representation, but that's all you say. You don't realise how bad it is. And then most recently Edna Shortall wrote a piece on how The Gate has not produced one new work by a woman in the last 32 years, which was just extraordinary when you think about it, that not one new work by an Irish woman in 32 years.
But even more extraordinary was the fact that Michael Colgan, when he was brought on to the Marion Finucane radio show a couple of weeks ago to talk about a column that Nadine O'Regan wrote about, what got very high, got these high horse about the whole thing. And I was just amazed that Marion Finucane was asking him a question like, so explain Waking the Feminists. I mean, this is Michael Colgan, as you say, has only put on a minute number of plays by women directors and writers over a number of years. It strikes me that this Waking the Feminist thing could be applied to a lot different, more sectors than just the theatre.
Absolutely, broadcast radio. I mean, for years I've been told, people don't like to hear women on air. Who said that?
I was told by a radio programmer once that there was, he told me in all seriousness that there was research done. There'd been research done. I'm still waiting for the research to arrive. I'm still waiting to actually see this research to show that listeners don't like female voices.
Well, it's true. And I was, there was a very good audio festival on Limerick that's started every year. And I wanted to do a talk this year about women who have broken boundaries on radio. And I found it very hard to find examples. There are sort of a handful of examples that we might, you know, call on. But really, there aren't that many moments that women are given the opportunity to break boundaries on radio. You know, there's Marion Finucane did with Nuala Fualan, of course. But, you know, we're not there. We're not heard on radio. So we don't have the opportunity to show our merit. You know, I think
it's really funny you mentioned my Fanuhi again there. Like a couple of weeks ago, we did a banter here with Brand New Retro, and Brand New Retro are the people who digitized pre-internet Irish pop culture. And there was a magazine. Maybe some of you remember this magazine. I certainly didn't. It came from the 70s and late 70s, early 80s, called Status. It was edited by Marion Finucane.
Yeah.
And it only lasted a couple of issues. It was published by McGill. And the reason why Vincent Brown in the end kind of shuttered it, he said, was because there was no demand for a serious magazine which is written by and for women.
I remember that of an age. I remember the launch of it in Liberty Hall, and I remember Marion Finucane and a number of women who fronted it. But again, you know, that was at a stage I might have been in college or something in the 70s. People didn't have money to be buying a glossy magazine written by anyone, never mind written by women. So I think there's something about, you know, the Waking the Feminist now. I think that there is, and it's not unlinked to the referendum and the sense in Ireland that actually there are a lot of things that have gone unspoken and people have begun to speak about things, and I think this is another one of those. I think the referendum on abortion is going to be another one of those, that actually the difference between now and the 80s is people now want to speak about things and they want to have their voices out there. And I think we could look at radio, we could look at theatre, we can look at right across the arts to see the underrepresentation of and the lack of the fair whip. If you look at arts bursaries, I mean, there's an unending list of areas where if you're trying to look in terms of an equal crack of the whip and equal access to funds, look at women's entrepreneurship. Every single bursary that gives money to men who start businesses up and down the country, they all give far more money to men than they do to women. So, you know, the Waking the Feminist is just put his finger on the pulse of what we've all known is, you know, is happening in the patriarchal culture that we live in, which is that we still have a male dominance and a male power. And if it's to do with money, and if it's to do with representation, women just aren't there.
And interestingly, walking around the Web Summit this year, which is, there were massive posters saying 10,000 women have been invited for free to come to Web Summit next year, in Lisbon, of course. So not really available to many Irish women, but, you know, it's across all sectors, you know.
Any other stories we haven't covered, Cathy, that stand out for you?
Yeah, I just have a few things I need to get off my chest.
I make myself comfortable.
They're very small things. One is the hashtag check your privilege. That annoyed me very much this year.
Why does it annoy you?
Because it seemed to imply that if you're white and not living in a hut on the side of the road, that you had no right to speak about anything. When really the answer to ourselves, of course we should all interrogate ourselves, whatever we do. But the answer, of course, is we try to do better. At least we're thinking about it. So I would like to banish that.
Okay, next.
The other one is this. I think I saw somebody calling it hipster tragedy. Tragedy hipsters, where during the Paris attacks, for example, and it became particularly annoying that night, and I'm including Mick Wallace in this, while I support his right to break up planes that are doing all kinds of terrible things and in Shannon, at the same time that I don't know if anybody remembers the tweet he sent that night. It was about militarism and how it may have led to all of this. My problem was not with his message, but with the timing. It was an appalling time. The Bataclan siege was still going on when he sent that message.
I think that was nice as well. The people kind of said that social media, especially Twitter, is amazing in the first couple of minutes after something happens, and then you turn it off.
And that is the answer. Because after that, it became a sort of this tragedy hipsters. It became a kind of a, bro, I've seen suffering. Where are you going with your pray for Paris thing, you know? I know what real suffering looks like. I've been there, you know? I would like that to stop. I think we're all entitled to grieve. I mean, a lot of us actually had relatives in Paris that night, if we want to be entirely personal about it. Even if you hadn't, a lot of us have been to Paris. A lot of us might not have been to Gaza, you know? We're entitled, I think, to feel particularly strongly about some things. You know, in an ideal world, everything would be equally weighted. But I think that kind of comparison, that shaming, that sense of, and I think the tragedy hipster thing was a particularly good example of it, because it really is people who have travelled, and most of us here have travelled, and we've seen terrible things. But I wouldn't dream of saying to somebody else, oh, hey, you've seen nothing, you know. Carrick Mines tragedy, hey, you've never seen a mass grave in Kosovo, you know. Mm. There is no comparison. All these things are terrible. So I'd like everybody to stop that as well. And I'm going to stop there. Okay,
that's good. One of my highlights of the year now is hearing Cathy Sheridan talk about bros. Grania, do you fancy that?
Well, I think I'm delighted to see Adele back. I have to say, the Graham Norton interview, the one of the funniest piece of her doing the imitation of herself, yeah. And the women in the audience, you know, going, that's not her. Oh yes, it is. I thought it was just great. And you know, I've seen her do a couple of things. So her comeback is, I think, very much about her being the kind of. She seems to be a real person. The fact that she took herself off and, you know, had her baby and did whatever she was doing and quite rightly had a bit of a private life for a while. There's a lot of lessons other people. I think she's a fabulous voice. I think the fact that when people were saying, you know, she was the wrong shape and she was too fat and she basically, you know, turned away from all that and thought, listen, I am who I am. So I am actually delighted to see her back. Mm.
I think she's a really smart, savvy woman, you know. She's got, like, I mean, everything she's been involved in is really good. I don't think the album's very good, but that's me being a musical snob.
Can I just say, I think our songs are a bit whiny, but that's...
Okay, we're going to open up the audience before we kind of libel Adele. Any questions, observations, things we haven't covered? Just put your hand up and shout. And don't be shy. The panellists won't bite. Yep. Simon, then the guy next to him. Simon?
Does the water charges thing
that
fizzle out, will it carry into the election in any meaningful way?
Water charges, is that going to be an election issue, or does people feel it's kind of like fizzled out?
No, I think it'll come back. In terms of as an election issue, there's definitely going to be, I mean, as a grassroots movement, I think it captured something at a particular time. It has fizzled out in some quarters, but I think the idea of, at a community level, there was a huge amount of energy. Again, there were people who came out on this who've never, ever come out on anything. Whether they will get anywhere with it and who will take it and bring it somewhere else, I think that it's an interesting space to watch.
I mean, I think the texture of the protest definitely changed, because last year when we had Banter Review of the Year, we were talking about the fact that, like, the water protests had united all these sides, and that was a kind of a scary proposition for many government parties, and that just seems to have dissipated, that, like, you know, the more well-to-do have looked at their pay packets, have looked at reducing amount of USC, and kind of figured, okay, well, maybe we need stability rather than chaos. But there's still a number of people
I'd also say that I wished all along that we had united under something else. I would have been very happy to go on those protests if they had been about the 92-year-old who was on a trolley for, 3 days or something. Guidance counsellors in schools, mental health services. There are things that really I would have gone and sort of occupied government buildings for weeks on end if I'd been drawn into it. I just felt the water charges were about money, and I just wished we had done it about something else. I wish that banner had been something else. That's all.
Okay. Go ahead. Yep.
I was late, I'm not sure if you covered it, but do you think our committee system is functional when you look at our politicians qualified enough to deal with committees, you know, the inquiries they're doing and then paying or not? Is it functional?
So you're talking about, like, the Dáil committees, the Dáil committee system?
The inquiry.
I'll make a confession. You know, one of the topics on there was banking inquiry. So I spent a couple of hours earlier in the week, just trying to get to grips with what exactly was going on with this banking inquiry thing. And I'm none the wiser. I got bored and I started reading the Dáil blogs.
I think that's how they feel as well, though. Yeah, I think that's how they feel. There's like 9 TDs and couple of senators, and they're all from different political backgrounds. They're never going to agree on anything. So no, but, like, I think it's a broken system.
It struck me that the banking inquiry was set up as a kind of a gotcha, and, like, when it didn't kind of go the way it was planned, they lost interest. But it's kind of funny, as you're talking, I'm thinking there are good stuff that's come out of the Dáil committees, but I can't remember what they are.
But isn't the problem with committees that we as an electorate voted against giving committees power?
Yes, you are absolutely right.
Yep.
Also, I recall interviewing Piers Doherty during the summer, who actually was a great interviewee.
Did the Army Council stand behind him?
No.
Okay.
We actually toured his little town in Gwydor and we had a lovely day, thank you. There was no army council in sight. And he's a very interesting backstory, in fairness to him. But he did talk about quarrelling with himself about whether he should go on the banking inquiry or not, because he always knew there would be nothing in it for him. You know, that inquiry had no teeth to begin with, as you rightly point out. And we are partly responsible. We are hugely responsible
but
for that.
Personally,
you, of course, you know what I mean? Well, I don't know how you voted.
I voted for it, but did you see at the time how the political establishment didn't want to have, and the tools that were used, the misinformation that was put out there, you know, to giving, you know, purportedly giving TDs power to castigate individuals, everybody ran from it. You know, this message completely obfuscated by vested interests, you know, was wrong.
Yeah.
It was also oversold, I think. I think people thought that there might be a finger pointed at somebody or some, and
yeah,
it can't.
I think this, as you just kind of said, the power of vested interests in this country is far greater than anything else. You look at the whole attempts to reform the law sector recently, you know, and how those plans were watered down. More questions? Siobhan?
Tyson Fury.
Ah, no, he's an interesting cat. That interview you did with Sean O'Rourke at the start of the week was, you know, illuminating and colourful. You know, he's the boxer from with an Irish traveller background. He's now the undisputed world heavyweight boxing champion, thanks to at the weekend. I mean, he's lost
one belt already. I heard.
Oh, I see. Okay.
I don't understand it, but I heard that.
Okay, he's lost one belt. Sorry, but like he's boxers are amazing characters. One of the most interesting banters we ever did years ago was with Billy Walsh, the boxing coach, and like just the determined, like he was talking about like his past as a boxer and how he trained boxers, how he kind of mentally, I suppose, prepared him to go into that ring. And someone like Tyson Fury, I mean, I'm far more greater admiration for Tyson Fury than I have for Conor McGregor.
No way.
Why not? Come on, Conor McGregor wearing a big nappy going around, you know.
Tyson Fury is a homophobe and a misogynist, and it is an insult to the BBC Sports Personality of the Year that he's nominated.
He's not going to win.
88,000 people signed a petition against.
Can I comment on the boxing thing slightly?
Yeah.
Because my father represented Ireland as an amateur boxer back in the day, right? So I know a bit about that story. And as a young man in the early 50s, he went to America, as a lot of men did at the time, for economic reasons. He emigrated and was entreated at the time to go professional because he had a bit of some, you know, reputation at his waist. He went to some of the events, went to some of the gyms, met some of the promoters, and he ran away from it. He had not come back home, married my mother, thankfully, and I'm here. But, but the reality was, he said, it's just so corrupt. It's all about promoters, it's all about gambling, it's all about mafiosa, and it's all about the showbiz. So yeah. When I see professional boxing as a sport, I do this air comment with it because it's not a sport. Mm. Average boxing, yes. And then we see what amateur boxing becomes with the sag over Billy Walsh and all that stuff this year. But, you know, so to see that these are all manufactured titles. These belts are manufactured. Mm. He lost one, so he put up a new one. You know, it's a nonsense sport.
Yeah.
It's entertainment. I can't call it sport. So... that's my view.
Well, I mean, this year with sports as well, with like, I mean, be it the kind of the FIFA corruption, be it like, I mean, more drug allegations for against athletes, you're kind of going like, well, where is the purity in sport? Is the purity in sport some old poor bollocks huffing around Fairview Park like in the mornings? That seems to be the only purity in sport. No vested interest there.
I think the only nice thing to happen in sport this year was, do you remember, I think the Germans were the first to do it at the big football matches. They held up banners saying, we welcome refugees. Obviously, they've moved on a bit, according to your reports, Jim.
Yeah,
but at least that's
some,
how it
some
starts.
Some, in fairness to my German friends, so only some of them. Only some of them. Any more questions? Yep. One first row.
I think the negative campaign against cyclists during the year was completely over the top.
We have no idea where you're coming
have
from.
Okay. Can I ask a question? Have you been stopped by the guards?
Yes.
Did you break a red light or go somewhere you weren't supposed to go?
I went through a pedestrian light where there was no pedestrians crossing.
Okay, what did they fine you?
No, this was before the fines came in.
Okay, have you become more a conscientious cycler, in inverted commas, since the fines came in?
I've always been a conscientious cyclist, but now I don't take as many of those risks.
Can I ask you, do you drive?
I do.
So you know what it's like?
I do. Yeah.
To have a driver, to have a cyclist cut across you?
Can I ask one more question?
Yeah.
Now, in fairness, the clampdown on Dublin cyclists was on the list.
Good. But if you've ever walked across Leeson Street Bridge, there's a pedestrian light and a cycle light at the same time, where cyclists and human beings can cross the road safely together in all other directions, and they figure it out, and there's no aggro, and everybody gets on with it. Why do we need these ridiculous rules? I mean, people have common sense. I just...
Well, you have an opportunity to comment on it before Friday. The Dublin Development Plan is on the 11th. You can go on to cycle, I can't remember the...
IrishCyclist.ie,
and you can comment on what you think the Dublin City Development Plan should be for the next 6 years, and you only have till Friday, so get your spoken.
We see, as
I meant to make that.
Oh, God.
You can cut that from the podcast.
No, it'll stay in. That was Zoe Cummins making that comment. But as someone who cycles, walks, and drives, you know, I look at the clampdown on cyclists in an interesting way. Like, there's been times when I'm either cycling or walking or driving that someone will go by with no lights on this time of night. It is the most annoying thing in the world. And like, sometimes you kind of wonder, cyclists should police themselves. Maybe there should be a bounty paid out when you bring down a cyclist who doesn't have lights. If you're a cyclist yourself.
I think there's a difference between cyclists who have their own bike and people who use the Dublin City bikes as well. As a driver, you do see the difference in how they treat the roads, I think.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, I cycle around town all the time, but when I'm driving, I do notice that they don't have their gear on, they don't have reflectors on when they're on the Dublin bike, so there's a difference in the way people cycle. Also, the much heavier bikes, so it's much harder to manoeuvre them in and out of traffic.
Yeah. It is also a fierce arrogance about cyclists, if I may say so. I've got a bicycle, and I started to cycle again quite recently after many years not cycling, and I realise how rotten I am at it. I'm a very bad cyclist, but I happen to do it on country roads. But I'm sure the city is full of people like me who think you just hop on a bike and take off down the streets, you know, where there's traffic on every side and pedestrians and everything, and they assume they can do it. Now, I'm assuming you're a very experienced cyclist. But you see, I think I'm a great driver, but maybe I'm not. I just think we all have to interrogate ourselves on this matter.
And just to bring it back to climate change as well, like, instead of bring it in more penalties on cyclists, let's work it out and not listen to George Hook every evening give out about cyclists.
Yeah, good thinking.
Yeah, completely. Okay, any more questions that don't involve cycling? Yep, Ben.
Considering Joan Burton's probably not going to make it through the next election, are we ever going to have a female Taoiseach?
Is that a loaded question, Ben?
No, not at all.
I don't know. I think you know, Frances Fitzgerald has a good chance of becoming Fine Gael leader in not too distant future. There's always Mary Lou McDonald.
But you're talking about Taoiseach.
Yeah, that's a tough one.
I think Frances Fitzgerald probably is a hope, because there is a chance that if Leabhar Adker and Simon Coveney to cancel one another out. And that's a terrible way. I don't mean that to denigrate Frances, who I think is a very good minister, actually. But it could all happen that she may be the person that will emerge standing from that.
She gets really good blow dries.
She does. And that's very important, as Hillary Clinton will tell you, yes.
Indeed, but I think that she, you know, in terms of what will happen, I think the next ministry, let's say, looks like, you know, the numbers are as they are, that Fine Gael are going to get in with the numbers. It'll be interesting to see what the next ministry is. I think she has done well in the two that she's had so far. The idea that she might end up in something like health, which is the kiss of death for anyone, I think, with a hope into the future of doing anything at a senior political Taoiseach level. But if she's any sense and maybe wouldn't take health and get something else, I think when Enda goes and he tells us he's not going to be here for ever. I agree with you. I think within, in terms of who's there, I think there will be others who'll split the vote. There'll be some who won't be seen as having the right age profile. And I think she has grown in popularity within the party. Yeah. And her ability to deliver on two referenda, as she now has done, that within the party, I think she's seen now in a way that 5-6 years ago she wouldn't have been, that she's really come to the fore. And I actually think she would make a great Taoiseach.
So do we all see Enda then being still in the top job next March?
Yeah, but I don't think much longer thereafter.
Okay.
Can I ask a question about that in the same context? I mean, how can the Labour Party, Joan Burton, readdress their image problem? They have achieved
name change.
Socially in particular. but how can they get that message across as opposed to the negative press to seem to have attracted? You mentioned a while ago about the messaging and delivery.
Yeah. Well, if you look at, I mean, again, going back to the British Labour Party and the number of new members that joined around the Corbyn vote, and I met hundreds of them. I was trying to talk to as many new members as I could at the Brighton conference. Most of them were under 30. They were all young, idealistic, wanting to change the world. And in some ways, when you've been in government, that gets knocked out of you. And there's something about a new, enthusiastic, visionary Labour. And I don't know that the people who are currently incumbent have either the energy or the vision to deliver that. So it's possible we need, and again, I'm not sure that Corbyn will ever be a Prime Minister, but I think he may be the one to give the British Labour Party an influx of new, vibrant, idealistic people who genuinely have a vision of the left, whether it's deliverable into a political party that will be elected. It may be in a number of years' time. And I think the Irish Labour Party, unfortunately, is suffering from a bit of the same ache.
But does anyone think it might have been worse if we hadn't had Labour in the coalition?
Yes.
Oh,
yeah. Yes.
And is that acknowledged enough at all?
No.
No. So what is it the media? Who is responsible for this?
I think that they themselves, I mean, like the way they've kind of carried on. I look at Labour and I look at kind of like, you know, I'm not being ageist here, but I'm looking at kind of people like Eamon Gilmore. I'm looking at people like Eamon Gilmore, Pat Robertson, and it seems to me that, like, you know, their idea for getting into government was to have one last time sitting in the Merc. You know, one last go.
Could you not also see that as one last time to be fearless, that they had nothing to lose?
That's what one of them said
to me, that he knew his days were numbered and he was going to have one great fling at it.
But what did he do? What did he do? And it's the, like, the,
well,
this.
There seems to be a little bit of agreement here that it would have been much worse without Labour. Am I right about that?
Yes. Well, he quit in a great job in education because he knocked loose. Like, Quinn did a good job. He tried against the what's less than interest in the schools. And Janet Sullivan's carrying it on, you know. The older guys now seem to be stepping back. But who would you see as the up and coming? Yeah. You know, who would you put in there? Alec Kelly, you know. He's vibrant.
He's a Tipperary. That's like he's got everything going for him.
He's also known as AK-47.
I got a question. Who is the up and coming? You know, that could change their image.
What I'm saying is, what are we talking about here? The media's always been accused of, you know, being cosmetic and superficial and all the rest. But if we agree here, and there seems to be a fair amount of agreement, that Labour have done a reasonably good job, why do they need a change of image?
I think one of the reasons why they need to change an image is that
vicious circle here.
Is some of their clothes are being stolen by people on the left. Some of their clothes being stolen by Sinn Féin. Some of their clothes being stolen by some of the kind of like Fine Gaelers. That, like, I mean, their position is being completely like other parties are encroaching on their territory, left, right, and centre.
So that doesn't mean they're bad people.
No,
it means they had good ideas that have been stolen.
Exactly, but
where
how
does that
back?
Leave Labour and the change of image? I want to know why they need to change their image.
So is it down to a new communication strategy?
I think it's down to new.
You know all about that.
Well, I think maybe just to go back to what you said just now, I think it's down to like new people as well. I mean, no disrespect to Tánaiste, but I'm fed up with her. You know, I mean, no disrespect to, like, you know.
Because she's a woman.
No, it's not because she's a fucking woman. No, it's because she's been hanging around. I used to work as a civil servant back in the day. I used to work in the Department of Social Welfare, as it's then called. She was there at that stage. She was there hundreds of years ago.
What's wrong with that?
But no,
I'm here a long time too.
No, Cathy, the point is, like, I mean, Grania has done lots. You've done lots. I look at Joan Burton. It's time for like, when it comes to politics again with the Corbyn effect. It's time for a new broom. It really is. It's time for someone.
Do you
new
think
to step
Corbyn
in.
Is too old?
No, not at all.
So why is Joan?
No, I didn't say she's too old. I said she's been around a long time. And
the ideas
have been stale. His ideas are different. Going back to what Grania said earlier on about being at a conference and looking at kind of the new recruits who were there. Look at all the people who campaigned with you, Grania, this year. All the young people who went out and canvassed. Are they joining an Irish political party? Would they join Labour in a blue fit?
I mean, will they start their own party? I'd like to know. Where are those people going? Are they joining Renewa?
No one's joining Renewa.
Well, now, you see, that's...
I'm being cynical.
So where are they going? Does anybody know where those young people are going?
Did you keep an eye on that, Grania?
No, I mean, it is...
we'll manage to persuade them to join Fianna Fáil.
In terms of, I don't think so. But in terms of speaking to politicians in Leinster House, following on from the referendum, and particularly, you know, saying to them, have you a strategy now for, like, there were 60,000 new people on the register from the campaign that we run, the, you know, the Get Registered campaign. So 60,000 people who were not on it, some of them older, some of them younger, not all new, they were all first-time voters, but some of them were just people who couldn't be bothered voting before, and this was an issue that they wanted to get on the register, and they wanted to vote. Now, 60,000 in an Irish context is a huge number of people. So if these were unregistered, they were probably not belonging to any party. Now, I haven't heard any of the parties with their strategy for how do we get that 60,000? If they're so mad about equality, could we not sell them the equality message? Like, Labour used to call itself the Equality Party. Why isn't the Labour Party getting those people and saying, come on in here, lads, this is where equality is happening. We're the party to drive that.
That's a very good point. It's almost as if they've lost the will to try and compete for those people.
Ben, do you want to make a short speech about the Sock Dems?
No, I think it's a lack of maturity on the behalf of the voters. I think you look what happened in the UK with the Lib Dems, and look what the Tories are doing now with the NHS and with the rest of the country. I think voters have to realise what coalitions are actually made of. Junior coalition partners. Like what would Fine Gael have done for the last 4 years without Labour there? It's the same in the Lib Dems. It'll be the same after this election. Like, do we want Fine Gael in there on their own?
I know.
Jesus, no. Oh, okay, what? Una?
Just ask one thing about repeal the 8, but before that, just about Labour, what Ben was saying, like, Labour will get totally screwed in the next election, and it's to do with, like, the standards voters have. So, like, we hold Labour to a certain, we have expectations of them. And so when they don't fulfil them, we punish them really, really harshly. In the same way, when you don't have expectations for something, you don't care how batshit they are. Like Trump, like, he could literally come out and say, by the way, I'm, you know, a dinosaur or something, like an actual one. And people would say, oh yeah, whatever, because he's immune by his own ridiculousness. But just a question about abortion going into next year. And in terms of strategy on what a movement will look like, because in terms of the repeal the 8th thing, there are three kind of campaigns, really, like repeal the 8th, you know, decriminalising women and doctors and so on, and free, safe and legal. And I think I'm just wondering what the panel would make of what would an actual vote look like, because people kind of, it's not, there's not much point in saying repeal the 8th when people don't know what they're actually voting for and what legislation will be made before a referendum happens, and how can we avoid the confusion that will inevitably reign, because, you know, the power in referenda can be with people who can use the most distraction tactics. Obviously the marriage referendum was yes, no. But that didn't stop the No campaign from making it about surrogacy and all the other things. So how can there actually be a streamlined campaign? Because the pro-choice movement in Ireland, the worst enemy has been the incrementalism that has been happening, that is just completely almost pointless without someone going free, safe, legal all the way.
Yeah, and I think you've put your finger on it. You know, a single campaign. We were blessed with a 10-year campaign by marriage equality to get the issue onto the agenda, and 100 days of a Yes Equality campaign, ICCL Glen and marriage equality, and the political parties realising that as a brand they were all toxic and they couldn't lead that campaign. So they allowed, in many ways, the Yes Equality campaign to lead it as a civic society, and that single campaign with this almost single message, the single look. And I think that, again, there's something about that. It's about pulling together. And we have had conversations with various elements of the Repeal the 8th. I agree with you. I think people will want to know, if we take this out, what are we actually going to regulate for? And I think that's where the big challenge is going to be, because you've got, you know, abortion up to 9 months. And you've got people who are, like, very, very limited circumstances. So back to the original comment, if it's about a referendum and you want the million in the middle, what are the messages that those, who are the people who will vote to remove this from the referendum? And I think you're, I think they will need to know, what are we actually going to regulate them for? In what circumstances? And that's the package, and that then becomes the message. So there is some work to do. So a number of people have been saying, you know, we need it now, we need it in the first 6 months of government. I'd be saying, we need some time to turn this. Now that we have the idea that there will be a referendum, we now actually need, as we did from the Constitutional Convention, which was in 2013, it was 2 years to actually build a unified single campaign, do the research, get the messaging, and there's a lot of sense in looking at that.
But will that encourage it to be pushed through very quickly, though? It's in other people's favour to have it in 6 months' time, so it won't pass. So how do you keep it pushed out?
Well, my concern is that you could do it in 6 months' time and it won't pass. Yeah. So why would you be doing that? Yeah. So again, in whose interest is it to have this in 6 months' time?
Yeah. Dan?
Yeah, I was just on the repeal of the 8th. Well, in that, the government this time seems to be replicating what they did with the same-sex marriage referendum in having a kind of a constitutional convention. Andy Kenny said that, I mean, before the election date has even been announced, he's basically said he's not going to take a position on having an amendment to repeal the 8th. It'll be put, he'll convene a meeting together and let other people decide whether the government should recommend for a referendum to be held out in the same way that it was with the Constitutional Convention for the same-sex marriage. I was wondering, is that not kind of extremely frustrating when you've got parties seeking re-election and they don't even seem to have the courage to commit to having a position, that you're outsourcing responsibility kind of again when, as the party who wants to lead government, surely you should say, this is where we stand on it. And it was kind of celebrated when Andy Kenny came out and said this, it was celebrated as some sort of a masterstroke, kind of further evidence of his genius. When really people should have been saying, oh, come on, it's a bit pathetic, really, isn't it? Have a bit more.
I mean, no Irish political party has ever, like, I mean, looked askance at procrastination. This is another example of it.
Can I just say that there, Una used the word incremental there, I think it encapsulates perfectly the debate around abortion. I think there's I described to somebody recently, there were seven people around my lunch table, and I'd say there were seven different views of abortion around that table. It went from the extremely conservative, no abortion at all, to not quite abortion on demand, but you could see how she'd get there, you know. I think the single biggest bogeyman we have in all of this is the UK situation, which everybody calls the worst case scenario. And that's, I think, is the greatest challenge we have. If you can convince people that we won't get to that point, what is that point? How have they got to where they are? Some of us are a bit taken aback at the numbers. I think that's only fair to say. How do we stop ourselves becoming that? And that's the problem, I believe, is free, safe and legal. Is that another way of saying abortion on demand? And if so, how do we stop that becoming the UK? And if we want it to become the UK, then we have to come out right and say that's what we want. But I think there's an absence of honesty, I think, about all of this on every side. And I think before we expect government people to come out and say what their situation is, I think we need to start coming out and saying what we think we want. I mean, I don't know many people in this room would like abortion on demand.
But on demand is a meaningless phrase.
It's like
elective abortion. Because on demand insinuates some kind of like immaturity or tantrum throwing or something. Like it is an elective medical procedure. Now, whether government wants to pick an arbitrary term for that legislation, if it's like 8 weeks, 10, whatever, but I think calling it on demand is... It kind of lends itself more so to people picturing, you know, opening the floodgates and all that kind of stuff. I mean, nobody wakes up and says, I'm going to have an abortion because it's an on-demand frivolous decision. Like, it's a serious decision, and I think that... It's very problematic, actually, to say repeal the 8th, because
there needs to be so much stuff done to actually have a package that you give to the people to say, you know, do you feel comfortable with this? You're not just voting on, because like everybody talks about 1983 as, you know, this big scary thing that we, you know, we lost, and that was 63%. But nobody talks about the four subsequent referenda that essentially the pro-choice movement or population won, you know, and like negating the 12th Amendment in 92 and the 13th and 14th Amendment coming in, and then Bertie Ahern's referendum in 2002, which was a repeat of the 12th Amendment, the 25th Amendment. And that kind of incrementalism is going to go on for another 15, 20 years unless an actual referendum on abortion is a referendum on abortion and not a referendum on, you know, bells and whistles around it. Like, and that's what I feel.
Well, okay,
The 8th is just saying we're taking out, you know, the constitutional ban on abortion, which we're the only country in the world to have, taking that out. And I'm not saying, and then what? Because it shouldn't be replaced with anything, in my opinion.
I completely agree with you. Yes.
But what is that? And I think that there's the repeal of the 8th has become such a, you know, dinky catchphrase and stuff.
It's language again. It's language and marketing.
The messaging is quite.
It was a good one to start with, but now I don't think it's nearly as specific. Think if I totally agree, Una. It should not. There should be nothing in the Constitution. But I think, what if we say repeal the 8th, it does need to be replaced with something, not in the Constitution, with legislation.
What is that?
Exactly?
And that goes back to what Corinne said earlier on about timing, about research, and about getting the bigger picture, you know?
Mm.
Okay, time for one last question and one last point. We've been through an awful lot tonight. We've been through we've been through Syria, we've been through Greece, ISIS, what else have we been through?
O'Donnell's.
Cyclists. Everything. So, one last question, and someone put their hand up here, so it's going to be a funny question. Yep.
Yeah, no, it's not as heavy, but in relation to the education equality trip, what's been happening over the last couple of months in terms of people talking about it starting to be addressed, do you think that there's a momentum there that will carry through in 2016 where we might start seeing some action?
Action on?
In terms of patronage issues.
In terms of people who are not Catholics before send their kids to Catholic schools. I'm very direct. I'm very, very direct. That's really what it comes down to.
Well, Jan O'Sullivan's promise to change the law in that regard sounds very hopeful. I think that is the absolute answer.
I want to bring up, and another something brought up earlier on. So Jan O'Sullivan wants to kind of change that. Jan O'Sullivan's been in power. I was thinking about this today, and it really annoyed me. People suddenly you have all these people, Aidan O'Riordan, who I don't really like. He's my local TD, and there's other Fine Gael, Fine Gael as well. They've been in power for 4 years. Why are they suddenly trying to get shit done now? They've had 4 years to get stuff done, and why suddenly the whole issue of non-Catholics being forced to send their kids to Catholic schools, that was there 4 years ago. Why suddenly this? Is there something happening in January, February, March that's kind of making them suddenly concentrate their minds on this?
I think there's been...
Sorry, I mean, really cynical here.
I know a lot of discussion around many of these elements, but actually, you know, the amendment of the Section 37 legislation, which finally allows lesbian and gay teachers to be living in schools. I mean, I was one of the people who lost a job many years ago before the equality legislation came in because of anonymous letters to the school I was a teacher in. I was originally a secondary school teacher, and I lost my job because of anonymous letters alleging that I was a lesbian, which I was. But but the idea that you could lose your job. So people over the years saying, oh, a case has never been taken and it hasn't had any impact. I mean, talk about the chill factor for teachers. So, so that particular piece of legislation, my own sense was the whole thing should have been repealed, but it wasn't. It was amended for constitutional reasons. But I think that is an extremely important piece of legislation. And on foot of it, I think many of these other issues, again, there's a kind of a momentum, there's a bravery where people are now saying, you know, I used to, you know, I got the youngest baptised so I could get him into the local school, but actually, feck it, I don't feel like doing that anymore. I just want to send my kid to the local school, and I'm not playing along. I think that there is a sort of, I'm not playing along with this anymore. And we're seeing that in some of this legislation.
I also think there's like a case in point, case as well to be made for kind of forcing the Catholic Church's hand. I've heard for years that the Catholic Church wants to relinquish patronage in many cases. They don't want the responsibility. Look at the amount of kind of Christian Brothers and convents, there's convent schools where there are no kind of religious members teaching. They want to get out of that ground. So maybe it's a case of forcing their hand as well. If you really want to relinquish it, like, off you go.
Well, actually, the bishops were complaining today about Jan O'Sullivan's announcement, and I did shout at the radio, interestingly. I just thought, really, you've been saying all along that you want this out of your hands, and really you're prepared to go along with what parents want. And now that the decision has been taken out of their hands, and rightly so, they're giving out too. So I think we're going in the right direction, yeah. Jim. And can I just say, I think it's been a little bit hard on people who are only taking steps now about various things. In fairness, I'm not making a party political statement here. I'm speaking on behalf of all of them, actually. This country has been through a really terrible time. We came from rock bottom in 2008, 2009. And I'm not saying we've come out of it. I'm not even saying we've come out of it heroically or very well. But we are getting there. And I think they have been very busy. As I say, you don't have to admire what they've done to admire the fact that we have survived. And they have been busy. So I think to some extent I'd give them a little pass sometimes.
Okay, does the question about like patronage come up when you're being shaken down the school gates in Clonsky, Zoe, for your tenors?
Does it come up all the time? I mean, it's exactly like that people have baptised their first two, three kids and they get to number four or however many and they just stop. They've just lost the faith and that's pretty much it. And they're waiting to see if the kid gets in or if they have to do two drops. But I think that a lot of people do play along and do a lot of people do want to play along as well, though. That's the thing, but there isn't the choice for those who don't want to play along. And the buildings are owned by the churches. And until there are buildings that aren't owned by the churches, there's nowhere for them to go. And the people who own the buildings do have a say in who goes into those buildings. So it's going to take a long, long time to work itself out. It's not going to happen next year just because the laws are changed. And it has to happen all the way through the education system, not just at primary, it has to be secondary as well, because there's nowhere for them to go on to. And it's secondary is even more crucial at the moment because there's people coming out of primary schools, and if you're in Dublin, there's very few places to go, you know?
Okay. Whew. Okay, we've covered an awful lot of ground tonight. We have 2015 completely wrapped up. I'd like to say huge thanks to our three formidable panellists, to Cathy, to Grainne, and to Zoe. Big thanks from me. They're now going to lynch me for various things I've said in the last 2 hours. Thank you all very much. Safe home. Have a great Christmas and a great New Year. We're back with Banter on the 9th of January at First Ford at the Sugar Club. We're back here in MVP on the 27th of January with Howie, the evolution of the Dublin accent. It was supposed to happen earlier last week, but we had to cancel it, unfortunately. So we're back on the 27th of January with that, Wednesday, 27th of January. Have a great Christmas, safe home, and we'll see you all in 2016. Thank you very much.
Thanks a million to our brilliant panellists for helping us bring the year to a close in style. This podcast was produced by Tanya White, and big thanks to her, as always, for her superb work on these podcasts during the year. If you enjoy this podcast, please rate us and spread the word. Tell your friends about us, recommend us on your favourite social media network, leave a review or a rating on the iTunes store, and don't forget to subscribe. You can check out thisisbanter.com for news where we're up to at Banter. We'll be back soon with another podcast. Until then, goodbye and take care.